There are so many fascinating things that I cannot wait to share with you today. But these are the three things I think you ought to know. The United States is the richest country in the world, but suddenly 42 million people there may have to go without food because of a government shutdown. I'll explain. Is the woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize actually advocating for war against her own people? I'm gonna let you hear what she says. And U.S. Black Hawk helicopters appear in Pokrovsk. It looks like some type of daring rescue mission. How did it go? I'm gonna show you. It's creepy. All this right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And there's trouble right here in River City. By the way, that song that everybody in America knows is about a con man. Just saying. So what's going on? Here's what I'm trying to say. The U.S. government has now been shut down for weeks and weeks, right? And while it's been bad and it's been spooking the hell out of the macro types, you know, the people on Wall Street and politicians and people who buy crypto and stuff like that, because it's kind of forced the markets all down. Most Americans haven't really felt it as much as you might think until now. Because on top of federal workers having their paychecks delayed, there's now about 42 million Americans who are going to have to go without food. And 1.3 million active duty U.S. soldiers who are not going to be getting a paycheck. And if that isn't bad enough, Thanksgiving is just around the corner. That's the busiest travel time of the year in the United States. It's expected that because so many airport workers are staying home, airports are going to turn into disaster zones. So says Vice President J.D. Vance, not Rick Sanchez. Now, all of this that is happening because federal subsidies for the poor that are in the books established by Congress, for example, for the poor and for the military and for airport workers are shut off. And you know what else happens when something like this happens, these government shutdowns, and the people start to really feel it? The president's approval numbers go down. President Donald Trump's approval rating among Americans has just hit an all-time low, with polls showing him almost in Biden territory at around 40%. And one poll actually has him around, look at this, 39%. By the way, Trump's numbers may have been better if he had won the Nobel Peace Prize, right? He wanted that thing really bad. Pretty much told everybody, I really want that award, right? Anybody who would listen. Even got his friend Bibi Netanyahu to nominate him. Can you imagine? But the committee went in another direction. They gave it to a woman who's an anti-government activist in Venezuela. And in doing so, they took sides in the governing of Venezuela, essentially politicizing what is supposed to be an unbiased process. Here she is. Put her up. There you go. That's her. That is Maria Corina Machado, the woman presumably hailed for her efforts to bring peace to her country. Just how peaceful is she? Well, get this. She just gave an interview to Bloomberg where she pretty much said that she would like to see her country, Venezuela, bombed. She also wants her political opponent removed from the presidency by force or by war. How does that sound for peaceful? You literally can't make this stuff up. Think about this for a minute. The woman who got the Nobel Peace Prize is calling for war against her own people. Here she is on Bloomberg being asked if she backs the United States' threatened military invasion of her country.
The increase in pressure and the escalation that's taking place is the only way to force Maduro to understand that it's time to go.
Unbelievable. Venezuela, by the way, is a country with a ton of hydrocarbon resources that Donald Trump would love to get his hands on. And that, by the way, let's not kid ourselves. That's the real reason for the aggression toward Venezuela and the lack of respect toward its president. By the way, when it comes to another two individuals and Donald Trump's respect, it's different. Russia's Vladimir Putin, China's Xi Jinping. There appears to be a whole lot of respect when it comes to those two leaders from Donald Trump. How do I know this? How do we know that Donald Trump respects Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi? We know this because he just gave an interview to a deep state flock corporate media tool, Anchorette, who I worked with, by the way, and I know very well, from CBS News. He pretty much told her what I just said. Here it is. Here he is for himself.
Who's tougher to deal with, Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping?
Both tough, both smart, both, look, they're both very strong leaders. These are people not to be toyed with. These are people you have to take very serious. They're not walking in saying, oh, isn't it a beautiful day? Look how beautiful the sun is shining. It's so nice. These are serious people. These are people that are tough, smart leaders.
Let's move to Ukraine, because there are some really weird things happening in Ukraine, especially in Odessa. It makes me feel terrible for the people who live there. The mayor was recently removed because he once had a Russian passport, even though he says he didn't have a Russian passport. And then over the weekend, a nightclub there in Odessa was raided by police. Why? Because the young people there at this club were listening to a song that was being sung, are you ready for this? In Russian. It's just a popular song. And by the way, the majority of Odessans, they speak Russian. But let's suppose they didn't speak Russian, right? Who cares? It's a song. It wasn't a counter-revolutionary song. It wasn't really even a pro-Russia song. It was just a song, a popular song with, you know, cool beat. I'm going to play it for you. But by the way, if you happen to be watching us inside Ukraine, where I'm sure we have hundreds of thousands of viewers, if not more, you might want to turn down the sound, because I wouldn't want the language police breaking down your door. Now, to be fair, there have been reports of police in Russia harassing street musicians as well, some of whom happen to be Ukrainian or present an anti-war message. Many of them have been fined and asked to stop performing by what they call overzealous police officials, evidenced by the reporting that you see here. And it would be wrong for us not to acknowledge that in this report, because it's also a form of free speech violations. However, what is happening in Ukraine is much more government-sanctioned, if not actually institutionalized by the government. Government agents being sent into the streets of Russian-speaking areas, and agents being sent to a club because simply they played a song that's in Russian. That would be like the FBI agents in the United States busting into an Enrique Iglesias concert or a Gloria Estefan event simply because they're singing a song in Spanish. Could you imagine? The fact is that since 2014 U.S.-backed coup that removed a democratically elected president, many laws have been passed, institutionalized, restricting citizens from speaking any Russian, even though it, in many cases, is their primary language. No other country does that, not even Israel, which is the most repressive country in the world when it comes to the right of its Palestinian citizens. At least there, they're allowed to speak their own language. Now, here's some actual photos from Odessa. Take a look at this. Those are police officers raiding the Palladium nightclub. And by the way, the group that performs the song, they're not even Russian. They're from Belarus. The song is called Glamour. The rappers have names that sadly I can't even try to pronounce. But they're very popular. And I guess now they're also very outlawed. What do you think of that? Maybe the better question to ask is, what does that remind you of when people are arrested for what they think or for listening to music or speaking the wrong language? I don't know. Cambodia, 1975? Nazi Germany, 1939? Let's stay in Ukraine. Because speaking of Ukraine, they've got a big problem, and it's called Pokrovsk, right? Pokrovsk is Ukraine's most important outpost. And right now, according to all reports from Western news sources, as well as Russian and Ukrainian military sources, it's being besieged. There's a map, there it is, where you can see Pokrovsk surrounded on three sides. And the gap on the fourth side is closing ever more every day. The Russian army has reportedly called on 170,000 soldiers to finish the job there, and many of them have already infiltrated the city. Meanwhile, Ukrainian troops have been surrendering en masse and giving ground as Russians capture the cities and towns that surround Pokrovsk from all sides. This is reporting that I've seen everywhere, by the way. The situation for Ukraine is desperate. And it seemed there was nothing that they could possibly do when suddenly they did do something. Helicopters just appeared out of nowhere onto the scene that I just described. I'll show them to you. Here they are. These are BlackRock, pardon me, not BlackRock, Blackhawk helicopters suddenly appearing in Pokrovsk. They flew in, apparently drop in, and also to try and rescue Ukrainian fighters who were caught behind enemy lines. The fact that Ukraine judged the situation around Pokrovsk so critical enough to risk high-value assets and airdrop special forces units rather than use ground transport confirms the severity of this situation. And it also, you know what else I think it does? It speaks volumes to the desperation that's being felt right now by the Ukrainian side. Here's Andrei Martyanov. He's one of the best, one of the foremost experts on Russian military matters. And he explains here how this operation, according to him, has been a complete disaster and likely involved CIA agents, one of whom he thinks has or may have been captured.
There are some big CIA paras there. So there were three Black Hawks. There are two of them down. I believe one was destroyed on the ground. The other was shut down trying to escape. The other one turned around. And so the couple of the, actually one major, another captain, I believe, don't quote me on that. But one of major of these forces, special forces, have been taken prisoner of war. And so information is they are searching for some big CIA people there. The only way for these CIA people is to escape probably right now, because they are blocked, is probably towards Mirnograd if they somehow try to escape. If not, they will be either killed or captured.
We don't know, by the way, if there are actual CIA agents there, if the CIA was directed, but we are getting a lot of brand new information. I was just moments ago texting with Colonel Doug McGregor, who was telling me what he's learned so far from the situation. Sounds fascinating, by the way. Here's another person I think is quite fascinating, Professor Glenn Deason. He's one of the most respected geopolitical professors in Europe. He's also a podcaster. He's got a great podcast, by the way. Attracts hundreds of thousands of people. And he and I have gotten a chance to know each other over the last several months to talk about what we think about some of the things that are going on in the world. And he's good enough to join us now to take us through his thoughts on all of this material that's taking place right now. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Boy, this thing in Pokrovsk is really crazy. In fact, I've just been told by my team, and I don't know if you can see it, Glenn, but we've got some video coming in. This video has been released by the Russian military. We have confirmed it's the real deal. These are some of those special forces agents or soldiers who would drop behind enemy lines by those helicopters, and they're basically being systematically taken out by drones. It's almost sad to see. You feel sorry for them because it's always hard to see any human life, you know, being vanquished like this. But look at this. According to reports, and there it is, there's another one. There was a soldier. Obviously, we're not showing the moment of impact, but those are their last moments on Earth as they're being eliminated. According to Martyanov, almost all have been taken out. And according to Doug McGregor, who just sent me a text moments ago. Let me just make sure I quote him, quote properly. He says, yes, according to my sources, all the SOF soldiers, the Special Forces soldiers, were killed and all the Blackhawks were destroyed. Wow, that's a hell of a thing, isn't it? What's your take on this?
Well, I have no information to what extent all of them were killed or at least taken, but it's interesting that the former advisor of Zelensky, Alexei Arestovich, he was giving an interview a few hours ago, I think, where he made the point that it shows the desperate situation there is now, that the defenses are so poor that as things are falling apart, there's a need to compensate for this by having PR victories. Again, this is the words of Arestovich. And the fact that you would have the intelligence chief of Ukraine being so directly involved in this, in terms of setting up the team and directing the whole thing, it kind of shows, again, the desperate situation. And again, if you listen to Zelensky's comments over the past few hours, he's more or less suggesting that there's only a couple of Russians in the city. We're just cleaning them up at the moment. I mean, Pokrovsky's, if you look at Pokrovsk itself, it's almost completely taken now. I think it's about 80% taken.
Yeah.
But now the big territory they severed off is Mirnograd. And there's, you know, it's unclear how many Ukrainian soldiers are trapped there. But there's been many who tried to escape this cauldron. And again, many lives got lost trying to escape. Others are surrendering now. And there's a lot of criticism, both... well, especially from within Ukraine as well. Why aren't they giving an order to retreat? Because there's a tendency, you see this over and over again, to hold on to cities long after it's obvious that they can't escape. And they're essentially trading lives for time, which is, just from a strategic perspective, it's not a good approach when you're in a war of attrition. Saving manpower is critical. But also from, of course, a humanitarian perspective, it's you know, it's heartbreaking to see, you know, all these fields scattered with dead soldiers.
You know, it's almost like, kind of like a PR stunt, right? It seems like there's a pattern that I've seen here. Saw it in Kursk and I've seen it in other places where there's a lot of information. Because over the weekend, I started reading, I think it was Thursday or Friday, about what was going on in Pokrovsk. And I saw that New York Times, Washington Post, BBC, all the Western news agencies and news outlets were reporting things look really bad for Ukraine and Pokrovsk. So it wasn't like, you know, RT or military officials in Russia saying this. It was like Ukrainian officials were even saying this. So all of that information was saying, uh-oh, Ukraine's in a bad place. Ukraine's in a bad place. Pokrovsk is losing. And instead of reinforcing it somehow with actual soldiers, they do something like sending in these helicopters, which looks like something out of Vietnam or maybe in Russia's war against Afghanistan. It's a military technology that doesn't seem to work in the drone era, but they send these helicopters in, almost like, Glenn, to make a show, you know, to grab a headline and put it on top of the other bad headline. You know what I mean?
No, definitely. And I that's also why I agree with the assessment of Arestovich that this is a way of coping and the deflecting attention. But this is common. There's common tactics whenever there's something, terrible defeats happening. Typically, for example, in the British media, they're quite good at this. Whenever the situation gets very dark, as it is in Pokrovsk now, suddenly you will have a British newspapers running stories that, there's a coup pending in Moscow that the military has decided to get rid of President Putin. I mean, it's a way of deflecting to make sure that the tension is not on the defeat. And to some extent, well, one can understand this, of course, because all the different variables in this war is connected. That is, if you have a humiliating defeat, then morale drops, harder to recruit, you're going to have more defections, more people will surrender, the fighting spirit will be gone. So you can see why some manipulations are pursued. But That being said, given that Ukraine has such a problem with manpower, it's, again, from a strategic perspective, it doesn't really make sense to hold on to these cities long after they're lost just because of the concern of the optics. And then I think the Russians are taking advantage of this because they're forming these cauldrons, and then Ukrainians can either go and try to prolong holding these cauldrons, but then by having fire control over supply lines, the attrition warfare is shifted further in Russia's advantage. So they're essentially letting Zelensky play this game of buying time in return for throwing away a lot of his men.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, just from my experience here working now and getting to know Russians and the Russian culture and the Russian character, Russians generally are not into a show. They're not into pounding their chest. I'm surprised they put this video out that I just showed you a moment ago. They usually don't release videos like this, and they keep things very... They're very tight-lipped about these kinds of operations. Whereas the Zelensky government, not Ukrainians in general, because I think Ukrainians and Russians are kind of the same people, but this particular government of Ukraine, maybe it's because he comes from the entertainment world, but man, everything is about the presentation more than the actual action or the actual process, if you know what I mean.
Well, the presentation has also been one of Zelensky's strengths as well as weaknesses. The strength is it's been quite successful in terms of drumming up support within the West. It's also good when he needs to get more funding or commitments from its Western partners. And of course, there's been a good amount of propaganda help to build him up. As we remember, he was... made into this new Churchill after February of 2022. But it's also a lot of showmanship, which essentially doesn't matter that much on the battlefield. And with each of these deceptions, the credibility also among the Ukrainian public and soldiers will begin to decline. So, for example, when you have Zelensky saying that everything is fine, Kupiansk, we're cleaning out the last Russians, Pokrovsk, there's hardly any Russians there. It's going to make it look very bad in a few days, worst case weeks for the Russians, when all of this begins to fall apart. And well, it is falling apart. If you see day to day, the amount of territory within Pokrovsk, and now we're down to, I think, 20% left. And there's no counteroffensives within the city of Pokrovsk from the Ukrainian side. So this is coming to an end. Mirnograd, they might hold on for a while longer, but it is coming to an end, no matter how it's spun. And so I think this throwing away the credibility, this is, for those... I watched Kvartal 95 as well, the Ukrainian program where... Zelensky was, you know, I've seen his movies as well. Most of them were Russian movies, though. But, you know, he's a very entertaining guy. I think the PR war is not the most important thing anymore. I think it can be useful, as I said, to gain funding and political support from allies. But beyond that, I think it's now becoming a bit of a burden, which is why there might be some pressure to have him replaced as well. And earlier on, you mentioned mayor of Odessa being pressured out. And this is apparently something you see, that his rivals are being purged, because once you have a good option or alternative Zelensky, then his partners as well, then primarily the United States, might look for a replacement to get out of Zelensky. Again, it's not confirmed, but there seems to be, he seems to be becoming more of a liability than an asset at the moment.
I read several reports about what you just said over the weekend as well. There are several reports out there, legitimate, credible reports, that he literally is going around and trying to remove anybody who he sees as a potential threat, or as you said, replacement to his government or to his power, in essence. That's a hell of a signal that he's sending, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in the past, he was quite concerned about General Solzhenitsyn because Solzhenitsyn had acquired from battlefield some credibility among the Ukrainian public. So he was seen as the main rival. So he was shipped off to, but he was too powerful to knock off completely. So he was sent over to the United Kingdom instead as an ambassador. But it is a difficult political situation, and this kind of begs the question: what might break first? Because you have the military on the front lines is going, it's just going from bad to worse.
Yes,
and economically, it's also going very poor. This is essentially what Europeans are now considering. Legalizing the theft of these Russian sovereign funds. And of course, the political stability might collapse as well. That is, if, again, too much rests on the shoulders of Zelensky, then, this could collapse as well. And you see this problem that once Ukraine now has this massive manpower shortage, how can you rescue the situation? Well, you can do more aggressive recruitment, that is to pull people off the street, but then you're going to have more of a social upheaval. More people are going to flee the country. Only the last 2 months was a report that in the British media of all places that 100,000 Ukrainians fled, young Ukrainians fled in 2 months out of Ukraine. So suddenly you don't have workers anymore, and they can't fill the military, the trenches, they can't keep the economy going. So things just spiraling very much out of control.
You know, you and I make our living off of our credibility. Credibility is the most important thing that you sell and the most important thing that I sell. If I tell stories that are not true on a regular basis, it's not like I don't make mistakes, and I'm sure I have, but I try not to. But if I constantly tell stories that are not true, eventually people will figure me out and say, don't watch that guy. He's an idiot. You know, he doesn't tell the truth and he's constantly making things up. The reason I'm saying this is because I almost get a feeling that the Europeans with Zelensky are getting exactly what they deserve. Because as we just stated, he has done this time and time again where he's played mind games, you know, and tricks and made a big show and created a presentation. And it turns out most of the time he says things that either aren't true or are exaggerated. But they keep reporting it like it's real. He said it, so it must be true. Even though we know he said it in the past and it wasn't true. I kind of think the Europeans are in a sticky place right now because of that, because they've never called the guy. They call the Russians on everything, but they don't call him on anything.
No, and it does remind me a bit about 2008 when they had the war in Georgia. Is anything that Saakashvili said was reported as reality? And the problem then is by being so uncritical, one puts the politicians, the media in the West, especially now in Europe, they put their entire credibility on that foreign leader telling the truth. So. No, I think it's they're throwing a lot of credibility away, and some of it's also been admitted. If you remember back in early of 2022, you had all these stories coming out of Kiev that you had this ghost of Kiev, this one fighter pilots just shooting down tens of Russian jets. You had all these different stories which were very obviously fake. But later on, the British media kind of admitted, we kind of knew they were fake, but they needed a morale boost, so we went with it. So you're kind of already admitting then that it was nonsense. And also, I think the credibility is also, I think more Ukrainians are starting to question to what extent we're actually lying on their behalf, because everything is portrayed now as being sympathetic to the Ukrainians. But it's starting more and more to seem like all the narratives, the common denominator is always to sell the war to our public as a way of prolonging it. So, for example, all of this horrible recruitment tactics they have, this dragging young people off the streets, sending them to the front, it doesn't get any much place in the Western media, because once people, if they begin to become a bit critical of, wait, what are we actually doing here? Why are we supporting this? Perhaps we should engage in diplomacy instead. Maybe we should pick up the phone and call the Russians, see if we can put an end to this bloodshed instead of boycotting diplomacy. Well, you don't want this if your objective is to prolong it. So I think a lot of the empathy now towards the Ukrainians, it's starting to seem fake. And of all people, this was a comment made a few months ago by Yulia Tymoshenko. She was, of course, the favored presidential candidate for the NATO countries. And, you know, she was making a point after the German intelligence chief said that we should keep the war going for another 3 to 5 years so we can prepare ourselves. So she essentially recognized, well, that's our worst fear has been confirmed, that the Europeans are now using us to buy time for themselves. So at the end of this war, I think we might end up in a situation where the Ukrainians are as angered at the Europeans as they are with the Russians.
Yeah, the effect of what Zelensky has done and the way that this war has been waged will end up having a very much a reciprocal effect on some European countries, not all, but some, because there are some European countries who've either remained neutral or actually been pulling a little bit more toward or favoring somewhat or understanding at least Russia's point of view, like, you know, Slovakia and Hungary, et cetera.
That is interesting, though, that it's coming from Eastern Europe and Central Europe, the Hungarians, Slovakians, the Czechs, some Romanians as well. This is where the resistance is now coming towards continuing this proxy war. And I also posted an interview today on my Twitter account, which is from Zelensky himself back in March of 2022. And he actually made this point himself. He said it was the 27th of March, I think, of 2022. And he was arguing in an interview with The Economist that there's many of our Western partners who would like to see a long war because this would allow them to weaken the Russians, even if this comes at the expense of the demise of Ukraine. He says this very openly. And this was, right before the UK and US was successful in terms of sabotaging the Istanbul peace agreement. So again, I'm a bit skeptical when I see all these narratives in the media, because if our point of departure was real sympathy for the Ukrainians, we would have an open discussion. What can restoring Ukraine's neutrality, ending NATO expansion, assist towards this end? Is diplomacy a good thing or a bad thing if we want to? If really the interests of the Ukrainians are first, would sending more weapons actually help them, or just ensure that Ukraine is losing slower, losing more men, territory and infrastructure? We would have an open discussion, but instead we see all discourse being shut down, censored, and people being cancelled if they deviate away from the narratives which are essentially designed to keep this war going and obstructing diplomacy.
Your friend and my friend, Doug McGregor, said over the weekend that he thinks, and he made me think when I listened to him say this and when I read his writings on this, he said that for Putin, it's a waiting game. And all he's going to do is wait out that part of Europe that we were just referring to, because he thinks many of those countries are on the verge of collapse. And he just wants to wait for those countries to collapse. And I thought about it for a minute, and I started thinking, well, does this really make sense? Because Doug sometimes can be a little hyperbolic. But actually, when you think about it, he may be onto something, because Mr. Putin is constantly talking to Mr. Trump. And even after Trump has said some horrible things, he'll still get on the phone and have conversations with him. But when was the last time we saw Mr. Putin engage with Macron or Starmer or Merz or any of these people? I can't even remember the last time they had any kind of conversations. It's almost like Putin in his own way is kind of like saying, whatever, they don't, it's okay if I don't talk to those people. I'm wondering, what do you think?
Well, there have been some efforts, some engagement from the Europeans. As we remember, the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, he made some efforts for diplomacy where he traveled to Kiev, talked to Zelensky, then he went to Moscow to talk to Putin, see if there were any paths to a peaceful settlement. And when he got back to the EU, they actually punished him for this. because he broke with the consensus, because we're going to isolate Russia. This was the main idea. And he was breaking ranks, so he had to be punished for diplomacy. I mean, but this is, again, where I mean that the narrative pushed by the media is becoming very, very dangerous, because As we watched hundreds of thousands of young men, both on the Ukrainian side and Russian side, perish over the past 3.5 years, a lot of these politicians, they see it as almost a moral achievement that they refuse to talk to the Russian side. I mean, if you pick up the phone, you can talk to the other side. You can mitigate some of the worst humanitarian consequences of this conflict, and ideally also possibly find a political pathway to end this war. Wouldn't this be a good thing? But instead, this has become a sign of virtue that we don't talk to the opponent, because our opponents are Hitler, they are evil. If we talk to them, that's appeasement. This is kind of the logic. And, you know, in order, it's a quite a crazy logic to follow, and this requires a lot of narrative control, a lot of censorship, and a lot of propaganda. So I think, a lot of the media is playing a very destructive role towards this end.
Yeah, thank God for people like you with your podcast and mine in my own way, and what we try to do here, and my friend Tucker, who, speaking of Tucker, this weekend, Tucker unveiled an interview with Nick Fuentes. Because he did the interview with Nick Fuentes, and Tucker will tell you, I don't agree with everything Nick Fuentes said. And Tucker has always told me, I talk to people not because I agree with them, but sometimes because I disagree with them. But because Tucker did an interview with Nick Fuentes, he is getting lambasted right now in the United States. They are going after him, I mean, viciously. The Zionists, who are neocons, are just literally attacking him left and right. And it's to your point, what you just said right now. You need to talk to everybody, whether they're your enemies or your friends. Conversation, dialogue is the beginning of finding solutions. Once you close that door, you're kind of in trouble. But the most conversations we're seeing, and the only reason I mentioned Tucker's name is because we're seeing more of a general adaptability and a general willingness to talk to the other side from alternative media, not from conventional or corporate media.
No, I agree. And they don't let on their networks, because if you say someone is a propagandist for the other side, this kind of logic, I mean,
yeah.
And this is usually how you would purge your opponent, a traitor or a Putinist. But what I started to notice was a lot of expert opinions, they're not allowed onto the networks because they essentially have their own conclusion. So, for example, on my show, I would frequently have people like George Beebe, who was the former the director at the CIA for Russia analysis. I mean, is he a Putinist? I mean, that's a very, you know, it's very far-fetched to become, but he's recognizing that, you know, in a strategy, you have to have an achievable goal, and you need to have, you know, the means to achieve it. He says, you know, whatever we're doing now, it's counterproductive. And also people like Jack Matlock, he made the point on my program that when him and Reagan decided to negotiate an end to the Cold War, the first thing they had to do is go to Washington and deal with the hawks there, because they didn't have the possibility to talk to Moscow without being questioned, you know, whether or not they were patriotic enough. So they needed first to deal with the hawks in their own camp before they could go to the Russians. And he was making a point, how is that different from today? We're not allowed to even talk to the Russians, the politicians, academics, journalists, because you're seen as being some kind of a traitor. So, you know, these are very interesting perspectives, experiences, and the personalities. Why aren't these people in the media? And it's because they have their own conclusions. It's that, you know, maybe Russia is not Nazi Germany. Putin isn't Hitler. They're not trying to restore the Soviet Union. You know, the war wasn't necessarily unprovoked. So they're simply cut. And that's kind of what I was hoping to achieve, to get some more balance. Because at the end of the day, this is not in our interest. If you're sitting here in Europe, this war is destroying our economy. It's with undermining the ability of Ukraine to survive as a nation. It's just a horror show on every level, and we might be moving towards a possible nuclear standoff if we continue to escalate. And so the idea that blindly obeying the NATO policies is in our interest, I think, is a very, very flawed assumption.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. By the way, a program note for my team in the control room, Gene and Boris, if you could, I want to play again that sound from Mart Yanov with Danny Davis. Let me know when that's ready, and we'll play that. In the meantime, I'm sorry. Yeah, if you guys got that message, let me know when it's ready, and we'll play it. Oh, it's ready. Okay. Here is, I don't know if you saw this, but I want to share it with our viewers. This is Mart Yanov's take on what just happened. And he describes the people involved here very rigidly, very affirmatively as CIA's agents, et cetera. Let's take a listen.
There are some big CIA paras there. So there were three Black Hawks. There are two of them down. I believe one was destroyed on the ground. The other was shut down trying to escape. The other one turned around. And so the couple of the, actually one major, another captain, I believe, I don't quote me on that, but one of major of these forces, special forces, have been taken prisoner of war. And so information is they are searching for some big CIA people there. The only way for these CIA people is to escape probably right now, because they are blocked, is probably towards Mirnograd if they somehow try to escape. If not, they will be either killed or captured.
I don't know what happened, and I'm sure we'll find out as we go. Apparently, it did not go well. If that was a mission, I don't think it was a very successful mission. But the fact that CIA agents may have been involved and the people who were maybe piloting those Blackhawks were Americans, boy, that just is not a good look. It seems almost foolhardy and careless for the Trump administration to allow something like this to happen, if they even allowed it.
Well, he should be more careful, I think, Trump, because again, he doesn't have all of Washington on his team in terms of if his objective is actually to divorce the U.S. more from this conflict. Mm-hmm. And also keep in mind that a huge concern for the Europeans is also that the U.S. will not just pull out of Ukraine, but then also pull out of Europe. Indeed, the U.S. has been reducing its presence in the eastern and central parts of Europe already. So the key objective for the Europeans now is to keep the United States in Europe and in the conflict. So there's a lot of ways America can get pulled into this. So I think Trump should also be a bit cautious about the hawks on his own side. But again, the deepening Western involvement, it is something that should concern everyone. As you and I spoke earlier about. Recently, the Russian intelligence services, FSB, they came out with a report saying that the attack on their nuclear deterrent back in June, that it was likely MI6 that was behind it. So the British, imagine during the Cold War, if this was a situation where we're launching missiles into each other's cities, it's, at some point, the anger will boil over in Russia, but not just emotional, that it's also going to be a recognition about the strategic necessity to restore its deterrent, that you can't simply have your adversaries, your American soldiers or contractors firing American missiles into Russian cities guided by American satellites and with the targeting of American generals in Germany. I mean, how long can this continue? There's not much more room for climbing up that escalation ladder before something goes terribly wrong. So, no, the fact that there's a possibility that, let's be honest, most likely some of Western intelligence services are involved in this. I think we're walking down an extremely, extremely dangerous path.
And in actuality, when you think about this, I mean, it's such the converse of what we're told. If you live in Europe, you're told that, for example, Vladimir Putin's another famous guy. You're told that Vladimir Putin is this horrible guy who's very aggressive and very warlike. And yet, if you think about what you just said, the attack on its nuclear fleet of planes, the blowing up of the Crimea Bridge, the derailing of railroads, the assassination of generals when they were back in Moscow at home with their families. I mean, these are all things that have allegedly been done by either MI6 or some other Western intel agency. And you, Mr. Putin or the Russians or whoever is the person who makes these decisions here in Russia, they've shown amazing restraint. I would argue that any other country that had those things done against them would be on the brink of war or retaliating in some form. And yet, very few people in the West admit to what I just said, or at least acknowledge what I just said, that there's some pretty mean things that have been done to Russia, and Russia has not responded.
No, so again, it does go a bit against the narrative that Putin is this aggressive and maybe impulsive, and that can't be controlled. If anything, it's not just that it's been restrained, but the fact that he has so much power and credibility in Russia as well is one of the reasons he's been able to resist some of the pressures to retaliate directly against NATO as well. So I always make the point, be careful what you wish for. If President Putin would not be in power, I really doubt that in the West we would like the alternative that would emerge. So, I very much agree.
I was in Turkey last week. I took a little time off with my wife, and we went over to Antalya, beautiful place. And I was in Belek, and I was playing a lot of golf because I love to play golf. You know, it's what we do when we get old. So I got to talk and meet people from all over Europe. Apparently, I didn't know this, but people from Europe love to go to Turkey to vacation and play golf, et cetera. So I met people from the Czech Republic. I met Irish. I played golf with Brits. I played golf with people from everywhere, the Scandinavian countries, et cetera. And obviously, when you're playing golf for 3 hours with somebody, you engage them in conversation. And we had a lot of conversations about politics. And of course, most of them represent what I just said about Vladimir Putin. They all fear him. They're afraid of him. They think he's a big, bad guy, et cetera. And I would ask them questions, you know, just friendly questions about where these thoughts came from. Why do they think that way? Because I don't know anything about Europeans. You do. But generally speaking, what I got, Glenn, from them was that was nothing about today. It was all about the past. They all told me, oh, no, the Russians are bad. Why? Well, because 30 years ago, 20 years ago, back in the old days, my father told me they did this, they did that. None of them, it seems, this is just my humble opinion, and please, you know, take it for what it's worth. None of them seem to be basing anything on relevant present-day information. It all came from, like, stories about the past. I found that really curious. Am I right? Is that what it's really like in Europe when you ask people about Russia?
Well, it's usually you get the most hostile opinions from the people who hasn't been there because I also very much hate the Russia I read about in the British media, for example, because, you know, it's a strange early 1950s Stalin purging, you know, the street. I mean, it's a Russia that doesn't exist. It's, you know, I think people should consider the possibility that perhaps there is some, that Russia is propagandized a bit in the West. I mean, imagine, over the past 30 years, the remarkable recovery of Russia, the hard spot, the difficult situation was in the 1990s, how this country was suffering. Look today how Moscow's become, the greatest city we have in Europe, and the country's recovered immensely. And yet, not a single story you would ever find in the paper, anything positive about Russia ever. I mean, what kind of conclusions can you draw from this? Is nothing ever good happens in Russia? Or perhaps we only get bad news or things which are skewed in a very negative way. And that's why I often go back to the problem of the media, because I think they have a lot of responsibility in terms of what has happened. A good example is what you just mentioned about retaliation. Whenever I make the point in Europe that we should not escalate, not sending long-range missiles operated by Western contractors, because that is a direct attack. The main comment you would get back would be, well, the Ukrainians have a right to defend themselves. It's like, sure, they have a right to defend themselves, but there's a reason why we never used to give ever weapons to countries in war, because that makes us a participant. Mm-hmm. If our soldiers are launching our missiles into Russian cities, then we are also we were also a participant in this war. If our politicians are openly saying we have to help to bring this war to Russia, so it's not only in Ukraine, well, then the Russians might also make a legitimate case for why they should bring the war to Europe. But, you know, this should be common sense. This is why we never gave weapons to one side in a war. But all of this goes out the window. So, but this is the media. They have kind of fed people these talking points, which doesn't really make any sense. But the main objective is simply to keep the conflict going and engineer consent.
Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing. As almost like, could you imagine, since Russia was kind of on one side in the Syria war, and the U.S. was on another side, if Russia had given Syria the right to launch missiles into Washington or Boston or New York? I mean, it would be crazy. And yet, in many ways, it's analogous to what we're talking about now. So finally, I guess we should finish with what you see. You mentioned earlier, and I thought it was interesting, that this thing can take one of two courses in Ukraine. Either the political fallout because of what's the repercussions of what's happening within the people of Ukraine, who are a good people, and I feel terrible for them, or the other side, which is just a collapse of the military, which seems to be underway if we are to believe the reports that we're getting out of Pokrovsk. Which way do you think, Glenn, that this thing is going to go? And I know I can't ask you for an exact timeline. You're not a soothsayer, but how do you think, where do you think this is going, and what's a potential timeline in your head?
Well, I'm not great with timing events, and also I don't have my crystal ball with me, but I think it's going to be, if there is a political crisis, it's going to be a collapse on the battlefield that likely triggers it, because that's going to be what deprives, robs Zelensky of his credibility. It's also going to be what sets in motion the other issues. So what you see now, for example, with the surrounding of Pokrovsk and places like Kupiansk and Konstantinivka, well, what's interesting with all these major cities beginning to fall is that it opens up the door to both Kramatorsk and Slavyansk, which are the main two cities in Donetsk. Once it's evident that they will also fall to Russia, then there's... the whole impetus for continuing the fighting starts to go away. But also keep in mind, with every major encirclement, when the Ukrainians not just lose a lot of troops which are surrounded, then also the Russians get a hold of a lot of these towns which they can use to concentrate a critical force of soldiers. They can be used as logistics centers to push further in. And after Pokrovsk, there's not really any defensive lines. I mean, if you look at the map, how heavy defensive lines there has been between where the Russian or the Donetsk front was until now, it's all been very heavily fortified defensive lines. After Pokrovsk now, it's very much wide open to the Dnieper River, but also they can cut up north, and as I said, to sever off Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. So it looks like a lot of things are falling apart. And as the front lines are falling apart, as the manpower issue becomes critical, you also have the economic issue, which is becoming impossible to manage. You have the political will among the Western countries to continue this. And at the end of the day, it just looks like there's no more ways to reverse this. At some point, it's going to be obvious that the best thing, not just for Ukraine, but also for the European countries, is to begin to pick up the phone and talk to the Russians and figure out how we can get out of this this spiral, because I think if we end up in a direct war, everyone will lose.
Yeah, and then it's got to be a pragmatic conversation and something that's realistic. You can't just say you need to do a ceasefire and you have to give back all the land. It's like, no.
It sounds like a joke, but this is what we see now. It's at the end of a conflict. For the Europeans, we lost this war, and now we want to dictate the capitulation of Russia in its victory. It doesn't really make any sense. Why are we still talking? I mean, things like putting an end to NATO expansion. This should already be on the table. Why? But no one's even discussing it. Instead, when they put forward this 12-point peace plan, it sounds like Russia has to capitulate. It addresses none of the Russian demands, none of them, and nothing about ending NATO's eastern expansion. It's nothing about restoring the right of the Russians in Russian speakers in Ukraine. It's just
crazy.
It's more or less for the Russians to apologize and walk away. It's a very strange document.
It's almost like you and I are playing a game of tennis or a game of golf or a game of basketball or something, and you're beating me by 20 points and there's only 2 minutes left in the game. And then I say, okay, let's start over. It's like, no, I'm winning by 20 points and there's only a minute left in the match. So... it seems silly almost, but Glenn, you're such a delight. Thank you for taking the time to have this conversation. I'm sure our viewers all over the world, millions of them who are fans of yours, are delighted that you would come on and have this important conversation where we're able to break down some of the geopolitics that are taking place right now. And people can find you. Where would you like people to find you? And if they want to reach out to you, what would you say to them?
Well, I have a Twitter account and also my YouTube channel, which is just my name, Glenn Deason. So, please follow. And I try to bring on interesting guests. You mentioned McGregor. I will speak to him in half an hour or so.
tell him we were talking about him. His ears must have been ringing, as we like to say. Take care, my friend. Thank you, Professor. You're very kind to share your time and your wisdom with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for us. A quick reminder, by the way, that we love to hear what you have to say. So go over to my YouTube channel, Journalistically Speaking. I think somebody told me this weekend I should change the name to Rick Sanchez, that nobody's going to know what Journalistically Speaking is. I don't know. Boris, my producer, said that a while ago, too. But anyway, it's called Journalistically Speaking with Rick Sanchez. And there you can leave your comments. I read almost all of the comments. I'd be lying if I said all of them. There's so many comments. But please go in there and write what you think. I'd love to hear what you have to say, and we'll share them here on the show from time to time. Also on Rick Sanchez TV on Twitter or X, that thing has just blown up. There's tens of thousands of people engaging and watching the material that we put out there. So thanks for being with us. We'll be looking for you next time right here on The Sanchez Effect. Adios.